morning, everyone. Thank you for coming out on a rainy day. Even those of you maybe who are living here, thank you for walking out. And I thought it was supposed to be nice today. Didn't quite make
it. It's a beautiful day.
It is a beautiful day. Nice meaning no rain. But nice is also rain. Actually, good is rain. So, I spoke with a few people while during the break, and it seems that several of you are new to Jokoji or new today. How many are actually just like brand new to meditation, never sat? Or good. Okay, great. Thank you for coming. And new to Jokoji, a few people. Yeah, thank you. So I was going to talk a little bit today about our intention in practice. And those of you who come often and those of you who come for the first time or the first time here, we all have some kind of intention. Everything that we do has some kind of intention. Everything that we do with any kind of consciousness. Sometimes we do things unconsciously. And we don't really think about them. But most of the things we do, including maybe the posture that you're sitting in right now, or the way you get up from your cushion, or your decision to come here today, or whether you're going to stay for lunch, or how much you're going to put on your plate, all of these things, all of our activities that we are aware of have some kind of intention to them. And one of the things about Zen practice, I think, by design, is to have a lot of particularities. There are a lot of things that we do in particular ways. And part of it is to remind us and to focus us on our intention. We don't just sit any old way. There is a particular posture, and it's been designed and developed over many centuries because it happens to be a posture that works very well. And also, there's something about it that also carries our intention of being focused, just right there in the body. We bow, perhaps, to our cushion or our neighbor, and that's the embodies the intention of Sangha and of our practice and our gratitude for our practice. I often think when I bow to my cushion, thank you for being there. Thank you for supporting me. I have a particular cushion that I've had for many, many years that where I used to practice at Kanando in Mountain View. We would sit long retreats, and I had just bought myself a new zafu, and I brought it, and it just was not supporting me well. And there was another zafu that I traded it for, and it still is going around with me everywhere I sit. So that's for a long time. I'm very grateful to it. So one of the things that we do, though, in Zen practice that carries intention a little further is that we take vows. When you all sit here in between the first and second sittings, after the first sitting of the day, everybody, whether you're putting on a robe or not, you're putting on what we call the mind robe, the intention to free all beings. That's the big vow that we have as Zen practitioners, to free all beings, whatever that means. And that's a whole other talk. I'm not going to go there today, except to say that I think of it more as meeting all beings or being aware and accepting of all beings. But that's a pretty big promise that we're making. And even when we sat down here, you all, in a sense, promised to pay attention. And I promised to do my best to bring forth the Dharma. So there's a lot that we are doing together that is carrying vow. And I think of vow as just intention with a lot more awareness and consciousness. And once we sit down to practice, we have the intention of coming and sitting with a group and seeing what this is, or maybe we've practiced for a long time and we're continuing that practice. Once we do that, what very quickly comes into our awareness and continues, I think, to be in our awareness is what Suzuki Roshi called things as it is, just the way reality arranges itself and works, and the way we perceive it, and the way we are deluded in our perceptions of it. All of that we start to become aware of. And then it seems just very natural, the vow, to really deepen and understand and pay attention to things as it is, to dharmas is another way we could say it. So there's a wonderful book by Shohaku Okamura called Living by Vow. I don't know if any of you have read that. One of the things he talks about at the beginning of the book is how there is this Japanese saying which roughly translates into ordinary people are pulled by karma. Bodhisattvas are led by vow. So what he means by that is when you're really not paying very much attention to your intentions, you're just kind of going along, then you're subject to karma. And when you're subject to meaning that there are results to your actions that you don't really know of or you know can't really count on or pay attention to, but there will be consequences to all your actions. Once you become conscious of your intentions and you take the vow to free all beings or meet all beings or be aware of all beings, once you take that vow, then you begin to live by vow, by that vow that you return to, even though we may not live up to it more than, you know, a fraction, we keep returning to it over and over, and that is leading us rather than karma. It doesn't mean the karma still doesn't arise. It just means that we are more and more led by our vow and our intention than we are pulled. And I think that's an interesting verb, pulled by karma. Or sometimes it might even feel like we're pushed by it. So a bodhisattva, we have many bodhisattvas that we talk about. Primarily, we often talk about Manjushri and Avalokiteshvara. But there's one bodhisattva who I think in particular, he or sometimes she is known as the king of vows. And that's Jizo. And I don't know if others are aware of Jizo, but if you go to Japan, you will see little Jizos and big Jizos. You'll see Jizos all over the place. They really are very, you know this, yeah. Are you from Japan? Yeah, and they're lovely and they're little. Do you want to say why you love Jizo?
It's everywhere and... ever since I was a kid, whenever I had a little qualms or something, just go to Jizo and put your hands together, and then it's as if it's gone.
Jizo takes it for you.
Yes.
So Jizo, and one of the reasons Jizo is so popular is that, first of all, he takes care of travelers, he takes care of children, he takes care particularly of children who have died. So you will see little Jizos with little bibs on, or little hats on. They really are they're quite sweet. And one place that we went to had like a whole mountain of Jizos. These were all the Jizos that have been collected over, I imagine, several centuries and just put together, and they made it into a big pyramid. It was really, some of them, you know, almost totally effaced. You can't see them anymore because they're so old. So Jizo took this vow, and this is why he's called the king of vows. He took this vow to return to the hell realms over and over and over again, as many times as it took until all beings were saved. And it's said during the time of the Buddha because the Buddha was getting old and he would die and wasn't going to be around to be teaching, that the Jizo made a promise to him that he would remain to continue to teach as the Buddha had taught and to save all beings until there were no more beings to be saved. So that's a pretty long time. So we might think of that vow as an endless vow. It never ends. And in a way, our vows are like that. We may not be able to keep them, but we still pick it up and go back to it. Just by taking this posture, we're taking a vow to sit down and stop every once in a while. And it may be for you, as it is for me, that your minds are very busy and it may seem like I'm never stopping, but you are. And more, the more you sit, the more you are aware of those sometimes infrequent, but they're always there, some moment where there is a gap between your last thought and your next thought. The gap where you notice, oh, I'm not out grocery shopping or doing my, you know, Christmas shopping or whatever I'm doing. I'm actually right here on this cushion. Or for me this morning, I'm involved in creating a program for a conference. And part of my zazen was, you know, working on the program. And then I would remind myself, no, you're not doing that right now. You're here. And in that moment is that gap and that vow to be here, to be more aware and a little bit more awake. So there's a story. What I like about some of these stories is, first of all, that that these beings who are they're archetypes, meaning that they carry energies that we find in our lives that are important to us, like the energy of compassion, the energy of meeting people, being aware of people, being attentive. And they're neither male nor female, but we often give them a gender because we can't help it. We're pretty dualistic. And we can't help it. But a lot of these stories, stories of Kuan Yin, sometimes she's male, sometimes she's female. And I found this one story about Jizo, that where Jizo is a woman. And this was a story, it's in one of the sutras where Jizo occurs. And in this story, she is a Brahmin maiden who is named Sacred Girl. And Sacred Girl's mother dies, and she's very troubled when her mother dies because she realizes her mother has done many, many bad things, and that she's going to, particularly that she has slandered the three treasures, and that she's going to end up in the hell realms. And so she really wants something to save her mother, so she goes to whatever her local temple is, where there is a Buddha known as the Buddha of Flowering Meditation and Enlightenment. And she makes many prayers to this Buddha over and over again, and she keeps going back to this temple, and she keeps praying for her mother over and over and over again. And then one day she's there in the temple, and there is she is aware of the voice of the Buddha, who tells her, go home right now, go home and make your prayers to this Buddha if you want to know where your mother is. So she does that. When she goes home, she is transported to one of the hell realms, where she meets a guardian who informs her that because of all of her prayers, that her mother will be saved. Her mother is not going to live in these hell realms forever. But Sacred Girl, because she's there in the hell realms and witnesses the suffering in the hell realms, she decides, this isn't enough just to save my mother. I'm staying here until everybody, I can free everybody from these hell realms. And so then, of course, she's no longer Sacred Girl. She is Jizo, And that's a story of, you know, one of the ways, one of the old stories, I suppose, from China or Japan of how she came to be. And Jizo takes many forms. There's an earth store sutra in which they talk about transformation bodies. I don't even remember all of the different names. I was looking on a website actually yesterday about Jizo, and they were like, oh, you could scroll forever. Or, you know, must be 50 or 60 names, and I'm sure that there's even more. They're supposed to be, you know, infinite. So these are the different forms that Jizo can take, because, of course, if you make a promise such as you're going to save all beings, you're going to need a lot of different you know, ways to appear in order to save them, because what is helpful to one person is not going to be helpful to another person. And it's the art, I suppose, of being a bodhisattva is to be able to be aware of the particular need of the particular person in front of you. So there's a poem I'd like to share with you about vow, and this is by Ryokan. He says, when I see the misery of those in this world, their sadness becomes mine. Oh, that my monk's robe were wide enough to gather up all the suffering people in this floating world. Nothing makes me more happy than the vow to save everyone. So, I really like this because, first of all, his wish to have his robe be wide enough to pull in everyone. And that's really what our practice is, that our practice, like Ryokan's robe, is wide. And we can include many beings in it. Maybe just the person who passes us on the freeway and is, you know, annoyed with us because we've been going too slow. You know, we can mentally bow to that person and wish them safety on their way home. Or maybe it's a relative with whom we're having difficulty. We don't have to really do or say anything, but there's just a way that we can include everyone when we're saying we want to meet everyone. We want to this is our vow. This is the intention of our practice. It happens. My experience is that it happens without really trying or working at it. It's the fruit, if you will, of our zazen. So how could a vow to save everyone, how can that make somebody happy? That's just so enormous. It could make you really unhappy and depressed and sad, because there's just no way. And to me, it's not the everyone, it's not the accomplishment that I think makes me happy or made Ryokan happy. It's the sweetness, if you will, of carrying that intention. It was a long time in my life before I came to practice that there would be some people who I felt perhaps had harmed me, and I would carry some invective against them, some, you know, bad feeling, some wish that they would stumble and fall, literally, if not figuratively. And the more that I have practiced, it doesn't arise anymore, and it isn't because I'm trying to be different. It's just that zazen does soften us up, thank goodness. And so one of the ways that this has become apparent to me is sometimes I encourage people and lead people to do a loving kindness practice. And maybe some of you have done that, a metta practice. And you offer loving kindness to yourself, to people who have been kind to people you were neutral to people who are your enemies. And my experience these days is when I do it, I can't find any enemies. I mean, and it's not that there aren't people who don't give me trouble, but you know, they just don't feel like enemies anymore. Long time ago, and I think it was probably in the first or second year of my practice, and I was having a very hard time with some people I was working with and considered them my enemies. And I read at that time something that the Dalai Lama had said, which was to be grateful for your enemies because they're your teachers. I hated hearing that. I did not like that. But it does become true that this gratitude for the stones in our path and the people who won't let us by and who give us a hard time, that it is this opportunity to practice with our vow, and that somehow, without really knowing how it happens, not only do we soften, but they soften as well. So I just will share one more poem with you by Mary Oliver. It's called The Messenger. And the first line is really what got me into the poem, but I'll read you the rest of the poem. She says, "My work is loving the world." And that seems to me that's that same vow of Jizo, to love the world. But anyway, she goes on. "Here the sunflowers, there the hummingbird, equal seekers of sweetness. Here the quickening yeast, there the blue plums. Here the clam deep in the speckled sand. Are my boots old? Is my coat torn? Am I no longer young and still not half perfect? Let me keep my mind on what matters, which is my work, which is mostly standing still and learning to be astonished. The Phoebe, the Delphinium, the sheep in the pasture, and the pasture, which is mostly rejoicing since all ingredients are here, which is gratitude to be given a mind and a heart, and these body clothes, a mouth with which to give shouts of joy to the moth and the wren, to the sleepy dug-up clam, telling them all, over and over, how it is that we live forever." I was just thinking about my comment at the beginning of about the rain, and Doug said, "And the rain is nice too." So my work is loving the rain and loving the sun, loving the world. And it's not work. It's an unfortunate word, but it's work in the sense really of joy, you know, joy in our work in the world. Thank you for your attention and intention to listen. And any questions or comments? Yes, Andy.
Just so newcomers know here too, that we have two Jizo shrines on the property that are quite nice.
Where are they?
One is right next to the Kobe Memorial over the bridge.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's another one out. If you go left on the property, you feel like you're not on Jokoji anymore for a second, and then suddenly there's mm-hmm. a Jizo shrine. There's little signs that come.
Nice.
Yeah. We have a third one up here, too. That's
Over
the Jizo.
They just pop
the
up.
Jizo is visible.
Under the tree.
Shrine.
Under the.
On the way to the Manzanita.
Yes, in the garden.
Lovely. Yeah, well, you know, these are the transformation bodies of Jizo, right? He's just going to crop up where he's needed. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes.
When I first learned the Daizai, it was translated, I vow to save all beings.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the Bodhisattva's vow. And then somewhere along the way, at Jokoji, I became aware that they were no longer chanting that. They were chanting freeing all beings. But no one ever, I never found out why.
Uh-huh.
What is your thought on why that change came about?
Well, I mean, I think the literal reason is that there are people who get together and decide what the translation is going to be, and they tell us, and sometimes we change it, and sometimes we don't. But, you know, the real reason, I don't know, but it's, you know, like what got them to think that was a better translation. I really don't know, but it is interesting to play with those words and how they affect us. So maybe there was a way that save affected you in one way and free does something different. And for me, both of those just seemed too impossible. And that's why in my mind, I shifted it to meet, which has nothing to do maybe with the Japanese or the Chinese or the Sanskrit, any of them. But it's what worked for me to practice with. So... what happened for you to have that change?
I didn't. I refused to do it for quite a while, and then finally I realized I was being stubborn, and so I. You know, and then I thought, well, at home I'll say, you know, save yeah. all sentient beings, and here I'll say what people say here, and. Now I'm actually saying free no means uh-huh.
But is there a difference in meaning for
yeah,
you?
I think
yeah,
there is a difference.
And what would you say?
And I think I'm just sort of cooperating, shall we say.
Uh-huh.
In my mind, the difference has something to do with what's possible, for one thing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and it certainly... does not seem possible to literally save all sentient beings, and nor does it seem possible to free all sentient beings, but I guess it means to free them from my karma somehow.
Uh-huh. So at least you can do that piece. I can do the piece that...
that involves my karma.
Right.
And
right.
Maybe that, and I would assume that the people at Jokoji who changed it, and I don't know who did it, you know, had some negative feeling about the word save and felt more comfortable with free because they
yeah.
wanted to be free or something.
Yeah.
That's all I can figure out.
Yeah. Well, I don't know how, maybe one of you guys knows how Jokoji makes their changes. We make our changes in our Sangha based on what Zen Center is doing.
Oh.
So it's not, and we are very stubborn. So there is, you know, when you come to the end of the service, you say all Buddhas, you still say 10 directions.
Mm-hmm. Past, present, and future.
Right. And so we have said, and, you know, Koban and my lineage through Les K, we kind of share some. You know, some chance. And a lot of the times when I come here, it's like, oh, this is the way. But you've already shifted a little. But the way we had it and the way Zen Center is now doing it is different. So we had to make the change. And we all resisted it. And we finally just decided, because we were thinking they were going to change it back. But it had nothing to do, because they did other things, like the Sandokai, that translation got changed. And some places changed it back and some places didn't. So it just becomes a mess. But I don't think it's just arbitrary, though, just that somebody likes the word. It has to do with these translators who get together and decide on it. But Jokoji being Jokoji, it may be that somebody did decide they liked it better. Do you know why, Cliff?
I personally think that Thoreau is part of that particular thing, but I had two other comments.
Yeah.
One is that there's a new translation of the Heart Sutra by Thich Nhat Hanh, which is quite significant.
Yes.
And the other is that Koban had a sort of a playful version of the Four Vows, which is...
I've heard that from Angie.
Being
Do you know?
Infinite, they will save themselves.
Right.
The desires are infinite, they will take care of them, they will find an end of themselves. The
Dharma
is infinite, therefore there's learning and study.
Mm-hmm.
And
the Buddha way
is unsurpassable, or is not above. It is accomplished every instant.
Yeah, I like that. She came to our group and said that, and it's like, oh, this is It's playful, but it's, again, I think it's what we're talking about. It's like, what feels possible? What feels like I can relate to that? And that beings are going to save themselves if we would just get out of the way. It's a little bit what you're saying, I'm not going to visit my karma on them. So if I would just get out of their way, it's one of the ways I used to teach nursery school. And it's one of the ways we knew we were doing a good job at the end of the school year when the kids didn't need us anymore. Mm. Yeah.
Yeah. I think about this vast sometimes too, save, free, and I kind of extrapolate for different ways of phrasing it to myself. And sometimes instead of free, I think maybe support.
Mm-hmm.
And then instead of support, it can just be maybe like aligned with,
yeah,
or in harmony with.
Yeah.
And then just with, and you know, just
with, yeah, being, be
just,
with,
yeah, just being with, just yeah, being there with things,
yeah,
you know, as.
And that includes all those very unruly beings inside of us. Because we have what a friend of mine calls, we have a lot of little animals inside of us that want to come out and sort of do, you know, sometimes inappropriate things or sometimes harmful things or, you know, things that cause us suffering. We have to be with those beings as well. Yeah.
Yeah, on that note, around here, being with, free, is anger a mode? Is anger a mode and a being? You know,
I think anger, yeah.
Being with,
I think we need the anger is one of the beings inside of us too, and we. I think that is a vow to take up to meet anger, not to be caught up in anger, or cling to anger, but to meet it completely. And look at it completely and know, how does it manifest in me? How am I, how do I broadcast it to everyone else? But it's really an internal kind of work of meeting that anger and finding out where it is and where I feel it and what all the thoughts are. And the more you apply your attention to your anger, anger is one of, I think, it's one of our most... important and precise, if you pay attention to it, teachers about ourselves. Really reveals a lot about yourself and a lot about your delusion. You know, whether it's things that you want, I want things a certain way, or I want people to be a certain way, or anger is really, it's a wonderful teacher. And it's also something that people are very afraid of because it causes a lot of harm. So to be able to meet anger without harming myself or anyone else, that's a lot of work. It's a good piece of work.
For me, it's one of probably fundamental work.
Yeah.
And
yeah, it's no accident. You know, we talk about the three poisons, and those are that's our work to clarify. With our practice, our greed, hate, and delusion. And we, you know, we have our individual karma and the things that we bring to it. And my experience over time, though, is that it shifts and all of it has to be done. But, you know, if anger is your big one, there's, you know, if you stick with it, you will be clarifying the others as well.
Yeah.